We're doing our Parsha summary, and we're up to the Parsha called Parsha Sadayeshev. Our Parsha recounts the breakup of the 12 tribes. We're going to see enmity growing in Yaakov's home, and as usual, we'll do a quick overview of the Parsha, and then start learning with more depth. The Parsha records the strife between Yaakov and his siblings, between Yosef and his siblings. Yosef's two dreams, he tells them to the brothers, they're jealous, his father yells at him. The brothers go off to Shechem to watch the sheep. Yosef is sent to check how they're doing. When he comes, they decide it's over. They strip him of his clothing, they want to kill him. Reuven says, don't kill him, throw him into the pit. Reuven is planning on bringing him back home. At night, he figures he'll pull him out of the well, out of that pit. They throw him into the pit, and then they sit down to eat. They look up and they see caravan. Yehuda says, we make nothing off of this, let's sell him to the caravan. And so they sell him to the caravan. Yosef isn't around when they, Reuven isn't around when they do this. Reuven comes back and says, I went to the pit, where's the kid? He's gone, how am I going to look dead in the eye? They take Yosef's colored garment, they drag it through the thorns, they slice it up, they dip it in blood, and they send it to their father saying, we found this, is this your son's garment or not? And he says, it is, a vicious animal consumed him, he's been devoured. He tears his clothing and Yaakov starts mourning. Yaakov is going to spend the next 22 years in mourning, and everyone tries to comfort him and it's to no avail. The brothers turn to Yehuda and say, it's your fault. You told us to sell him and we listened. If you would have said to bring him back, we would have listened. They demote Yehuda from his leadership status. Yehuda is distanced by his brothers. He goes, marries, has three children. The children grow up. They reach the ripe old age of 7.5, his eldest. He marries him off. And he is sinful. Yes. Now, this is one of those drushes you could actually check. Do the math in the Torah and you'll see there's no other way. Do the math of how many generations were born and the ages. Yosef goes down to Egypt, it says he was 17, he becomes king, he was 30, 7 years of food, 2 years of famine. That's all written in the Torah. So a total, Yosef is 39, 22 years will pass, recorded in the Torah, between Yosef's sale and the family coming down to Egypt. During those 22 years we will witness how Yehuda will have three generations. How does that happen? Three generations in 22 years is so the Gemara says, must be they all could have kids at age 7, which the Gemara says they couldn't do in the Gemara's time either. The Gemara says they were an anomaly. Things changed.
So the speaking is, if they were 7.5, they were capable to have
kids, right? Kid.
So they were far more mature than
right?
Us.
Correct. He marries a tremendous tzaddikus named Tamar. He is sinful. He dies. They do Yibum. The second brother, Onan, is also sinful. He too dies. Yehuda tells the widow, wait around. You know, he's too little. He's only 5. You know, we got to wait till he's 7. She waits. Yehuda's wife dies. Yehuda should really take Tamar in, or at least marry off his son now that there's no mother. He doesn't. So she goes and gets dressed, she removes her black clothing of mourning and gets dressed nicely, and she hopes Yehuda's going to see her and say, hey Tamar, what's going on? How come you're not dressed like a widow? Yehuda sees her and he doesn't recognize her. Shows us how modest Yehuda was and how modest she was. Yehuda says, what do you say you and I go together? And she says, Yehuda, what are you going to pay me? She tries to bring him into conversation. Maybe he'll recognize who she is, what's going on. Yehuda says, I'll send you a goat. She says, maybe give me collateral. She figures, we'll talk a little more. I'll figure out who I am. Yehuda doesn't figure it out. He says, what collateral am I giving you? So she tells him, okay. She gives him a list of what she wants for collateral. He gives it to her. She says, okay, if this is the way God wants it. Bottom line, he does have a mitzvah to marry me if his children didn't marry me. Okay. she goes back home. She gets dressed up again in her widow's clothing. Yehuda sends the goat and she's not around. This wasn't what she was doing for fun. They try to find out where she is and they tell them, we don't know who you're talking about. So Yehuda says, what can we do? We tried ours. 3 months later, Yehuda hears that his daughter-in-law is pregnant. She was supposed to be waiting for his son. So he says, okay, the law of the time was that a woman who was supposed to be waiting for, once she was like engaged and she cheated on the betrothed, then she got burnt. One understanding is she got burnt at the stake. One understanding is they used to take a hot coal, put it on her forehead, and for the rest of her life she'd have like a sign that said, I cheated on my, that was a sign. So whatever it means, she was on her way to have that done to her. And she said, send these, the collateral, to Yehuda and tell him if he wants to know who fathered this child, this is who it is. Yehuda sees it and says, hey, that's mine, I did it. So she has twins, and those twins are the source of the Davidic dynasty and the king Mashiach. Yosef goes down to Egypt. He is purchased by Potiphar, who is the top butcher of the kings, either butcher of meat or butcher of people, either the top executioner or top butcher. And Yosef is very successful, so they put him in charge of everything. Yosef starts looking good, and God is with Yosef, and you think his tests are over, and in life the tests are never over. So you have a young man sitting there looking exceptionally good, and the master's wife looks at him and says, come lie with me. And he refuses, and she says again, and he refuses, and she says again, and he refuses. And we'll go into that Bezachem next time. And those of you who want, we have a long class on this in Chassidut from last year, the conversations that went on between Yosef and Potiphar's wife. So there are Midrashim about it, and there's Chassidut about it. One day, no one's around, she grabs him by his robe and says, come lay with me. And he refuses. He slips out of his robe, and in those days they didn't have underwear. So he's stark naked, runs out into the street. She sees, uh-oh, this doesn't look too good. I'm here with his robe. He's out in the street naked. What are people going to say? So she says, she calls everyone in and says, did you hear me yell? They say, no. She says, what? Didn't you hear? I was yelling. He was coming. To make a long story short, Yosef gets thrown into jail. And the parsha concludes with new dreams. The parsha began with the dreams of Yosef. The parsha concludes with the dreams of two officers of Paro who were also incarcerated in that jail, and Yosef's interpretation of the dreams. There's the baker and the one who used to serve the wine, and Yosef interprets the baker's dream to mean that he will be executed in 3 days, and the winemaker's dream, the guy who was in charge of serving the wine, that he will be the butler, right? That's what it's called, the butler's dream. That he will be returned to his post in 3 days. And he asked the butler, when you return to your post, remember me, help me get out of here. I've done nothing wrong. And the butler sees that Yosef's interpretations come true. And he says, let the boy rot. And leaves him back in jail. And makes no mention of Yosef. So now let's begin our parsha. Our parsha is a blemish in the mark on Jewish history. A millennium after our parsha, the Navi turns to the Jewish people and says, על ארבעה, על שלושה פשעי ישראל ועל ארבעה לא אשיבנו. We learn in Treyasar, at the end of prophecy, you're talking about the last prophets towards the destruction of the first temple. Over a millennium has passed since this story, and the Navi says to the Jewish people, you should know there's this sin that's waiting, hovering over you. על מכרם בכסף צדיק, because they sold the righteous one for money. And they sold the impoverished one, also a reference to Yosef, bavun alaim, for a set of shoes. And that's where we derive that Yosef was sold for shoes. The brothers each got a pair of shoes, as we learned in the Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer. And this is in Amos, you guys could look it up, it's after this week's parsha. The sin was hovering over us, Chazal tell us, through the period of the Second Temple as well. So we have to understand, firstly, that Yosef is called the tzaddik. Micham b'kesef tzaddik. Yaakov views him positively. The Navi, a millennium later, tells us he was a tzaddik. So whatever we're about to say about Yosef, we got to take with a grain of salt, because Yosef is called a tzaddik. I mean, not many people in the Torah are called a tzaddik. On the other end, we have to know that the brothers were also tzaddikim. We're talking about people, they're Shivtei Ka. They're the tribes of God, that God says, this is Israel. This is the source of Israel. God says they correspond to the world. The 12 tribes correspond to the 12 months, correspond to the zodiac. There's a correspondence. This is the foundation of the world. Just like we say the forefathers, the Avot, are the foundation of the world, so too the 12 tribes are the foundation of the world. To the point where the Talmud asks, why don't we call the tribes Avot? Why don't we call them forefathers? They are the forefathers of the people. So we're talking about great people, and we're talking about things that on the surface are terrible, and beyond the surface, right? So I don't think I will give you an answer that you'll be fully at peace with. I'm telling you now. We have three givens here that contradict one another. Given number one, Yosef is a great tzaddik. Given number two, the brothers are great tzaddikim. Given number three, what the brothers did was wrong. And what Yosef did was wrong. So how do we reconcile all of this? So we have to understand that there were mistakes made. But it wasn't as vicious as the story is going to appear. That's evident from the facts we just laid out. There were mistakes made. Yosef made mistakes. The brothers made mistakes. The brothers' mistakes they paid for. Yosef's mistakes he paid for. Everyone made mistakes here. Yaakov made mistakes. And we have to learn from those mistakes. And that's why we will discuss those mistakes. At the same time, we have to remember that we're using terminology as though they were our counterparts on our level. And they were nowhere near that. We don't begin to fathom their strengths. The same Yehuda we're going to talk about in our parsha, Chazal tell us, would stand and let out a roar that would be heard countries over. People fell off their chairs from the roar he let out. So what's that telling us? It was bigger than the Hulk? I think it's telling us something else. It's telling us about the strengths that they had. The spiritual strengths, the physical strengths, they go hand in hand. These were unusual people. And these were tremendous tzaddikim. On the one hand, we're going to learn about the sale of Yosef, and we said that sale has been a blemish on our record throughout our history. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, when they make a pact that no one's going to tell, God joins in on that pact. Well, why did God join if they were so dead wrong? So obviously there's more here. We won't have time to explore all aspects. It's a big parsha, and there's a lot to discuss. We're going to touch on points, and if you're really curious, check online. We have classes from previous years where we spent more time on it. But we'll try. Yeah. We're going to have to limit questions. I'm listening, but if it's long, we'll have to limit it. Yeah.
If Avram knew they would go down, and Hashem foretold it, so Yaakov also should have known. So his father told him, so he knew this would happen.
Correct. They knew they were headed to exile.
They knew they were heading for the exile.
Correct. Let's begin. God had told Avram, as Yonatan correctly pointed out, that we're headed for exile. And yet, the first 190 years had passed uneventfully. The first 190 years of the exile, up until next week's parsha. In our parsha, we're holding 160 years have passed. And we're still in Israel, and the reason behind it is because we didn't yet own the land of Israel. God had promised Avram Avinu, Yodoa Teda, Ki Geri Yezaracha Be'eretz Lo Laem, your seed will be strangers, sojourners in a land that does not belong to them for 400 years. Well, so long as we were sojourners, we were strangers, we could stay in the land of Israel. The second we start being comfortable, this is my land, so then we got problems. Vayeshev Yaakov, when Yaakov tries to settle down, Be'eretz Migurei Aviv, in the land where his father was Pachad Yitzchak, living in fear of the future. He was Migurei. Migurei means fear. Migurei means ger. He was a sojourner. He was a stranger. He knew his place in the land of Israel. So Yitzchak could stay in the land of Israel without problems. When Yaakov tries to settle down, God says, no, Yaakov, you can't do that. If you're going to settle down, then this won't count for your 400 years. And so God sends him problems. Yaakov has one child from Rachel, and then he has another child from Rachel. When the second child is born, Rachel dies. So now he has to raise an orphan. He has Binyamin, who's an orphan, and he has Yosef, the elder. When Reuven sins with Yaakov's wife Bilhah, so then the one to tell Yaakov is Yosef. Yosef brings the bad news about the brothers to Yaakov. And Yosef is unusually smart, as we will see. Look throughout the Tanakh, I challenge you to find a king that reigned longer than Yosef. Yosef is going to be king for 80 years. King of Egypt. 80 years he is viceroy of Egypt. Yosef. Yosef is appointed second in command, and technically he's running Egypt for 80 years. He is brilliant. And he is the one that makes the Egyptian empire into what it was. The empire that could subdue the Jews for those 210 years. But Yosef's brilliance is a double-edged sword. It is brilliance of a specific nature. He is nonetheless a na'ar. He is young, and he does not have the foresight that the elders have. Sometimes you see someone who's exceptionally young, and you figure, let's see what he has to say. Chazal say, don't do that. He could be very smart, but he's not yet age. He doesn't yet have the foresight that comes with age. And that's why Yosef, on the one end, he has dreams that are true. He has dreams that he interprets correctly. He is brilliant, and his father appoints him as leader among the brothers. His father appoints him to see to it that the brothers are doing what they're doing correctly. On the other hand, he errs. He tells the brothers about his dreams, and he is not good politically. He doesn't set things up in a way that the brothers are comfortable. They feel like he's a tyrant, he's a boss. And so their relationship with him is just like a boss and a worker. If you have a tough boss, so you talk to him what you gotta talk to him and nothing else. They couldn't talk to him like brothers in peace. There wasn't any brotherly love developing there. There was enmity growing there. He was the big boss. Now there was a reason he was the big boss. He knew what he was doing. He was the best shepherd among them. When they're out in Shechem, his father's gonna send him out there and say, go check, see if they aren't messing up. And Yosef comes back to the father each time and says they're misinvesting and they're misappropriating funds and they're ruining the empire. They were very wealthy people. Yosef was really the brilliant one who knew how to lead their assets. And Yosef was right. He was right about what he said, not the way he said it. Shmuel, I'm with you.
Yeah, Rabbi, I just want to ask you, so like, do you know maybe like in Egyptian history, like if there was anything called such as a Jew person, whoever was over controlling Egypt? Is there any historical source? Like, I'm just wondering.
I'm unaware that previous years I researched in, I don't remember what I came up with. But you could look 3 or 4 years ago, see what I mentioned in class. I don't remember.
Okay.
So the brothers see that Yosef gets this unusual treatment, and they hate him. Yaakov makes a vest for each child, and Yosef gets a stripe at the end of the sleeve. One little stripe. But you know what? If everyone has a navy blue blazer, and he has a navy blue blazer with a little stripe around the end, that's enough to create the greatest jealousy. And the brothers are jealous. And Chazal tell us that Yaakov erred. Lo'olam al yishaneh adam bno ben abanim. A person should never treat one child different than the others. Even though one child has different talents than the others, we have to be careful from showing favoritism. And Yaakov exhibited favoritism to Yosef. Technically, Yosef was an orphaned son. Yosef was the eldest boy he had from his chosen wife. And nonetheless, Chazal say, Yaakov erred. That's what Chazal tell us. So, Yosef has a dream. He says, made piles in this field. My pile stood up and remained erect. And this is an allusion to the fact that he would be leader and he would remain a leader for a long period, which he did. And then your pile surrounded mine and bowed to it, which is what they will do in next week's parasha. They will come to him for the sake of grain. They will come to him for sustenance, and they will bow to him for that sustenance. And the brothers tell him, do you think you're going to be king? You know, dreams stem from what we think about by day. There was once a king who called in the rabbi and said, Gemara brings the story. King calls in the rabbi and says, tell me what I'm going to dream tonight. He didn't tell him interpret a dream. He tells him, tell me what I'm going to dream and what the interpretation is going to be. So he told him. And that's what the king dreamt that night. So the Gemara says, how do you do it? The Gemara says, whatever you're worried about by day, those are the thoughts that come up to your mind at night. So he knew that politically this king was worried about a certain threat politically. And so he told him, that's all you'll dream about at night. All day long the king was thinking, what's the dream going to be? Is it really going to be about that political threat? It was. That's what he was thinking about all day. The brothers tell him, so this is what you've been thinking about all day, that you're going to rule over us. You're going to be king over us. He has a second dream and he tells them about the sun and the moon and the 11 stars bowing to him. And his father yells at him and says, what's wrong with you? This is what you're thinking about by day, how you're going to be king over everyone? Me, your mother, your brothers, we're all going to bow to you? In truth, his father was not jealous of him. A normal father is never jealous of the child. He expressed it as though he was jealous. He said, I'm going to bow to you. The Torah tells us behind the scenes his father was waiting, hoping it would come true. He was waiting for the day he'd bow before Yosef. He wanted Yosef to attain that greatness. Yes?
Mother's dead.
So Chazal tell us, Malateven et habav. Why is it that whenever you have wheat, you always have some other stuff mixed in that's not true wheat? To teach us that that's a pasuk. That just like you can't have wheat without some chaff and some other stuff mixed in that's unnecessary, so too you can't have a dream without some parts of the dream that are not true. So you never know which parts of the dream are true. The brothers go out to Shechem, which is a question unto itself. Why? They ran away from Shechem. Why'd they go back? What?
Because they hid away from the brothers because they were afraid of him, right?
I don't know. I never heard that, John. They're not too far away from Shechem. They go to Shechem, and Yaakov calls Yosef and says, you know, they're not so far away there in Shechem. Go see how they're doing. Yosef says, whatever you say. He says, I want you to check out, you know, if it's only a matter of seeing how they're doing, I'd send a servant, but I know you, and I want you to check how they're running the show there. So Yosef goes. Yes?
They were in Hebron at the time? And yeah. They went to Shechem?
I don't know where they were living. I don't know. Sorry. So his father accompanies him and walks him from the mountains of Hebron down to the valley. Yeah, it says Vayishchem me'emek Hebron, right? Walks him down to the valley. Chazal tell us that he was teaching him halacha. If a Jew is found murdered, we measure, we try to verify where the murderers come from. And then if we cannot verify, so the Torah gives us a mitzvah called Egla Rufa. You send elders from the high court in Jerusalem, and you bring elders from the closest city, and you do a whole procession. You bring a young calf, and you execute the calf in a specific way. Very specific stuff is done, and then the place where the calf's blood goes down is never planted as a memory that a person was killed here, murdered here. And that's all to get word out. You know, most people never see an Egla Rufa in their life. You hear, down there there's an Egla Rufa. People are going to talk about it. They're going to say, why is there an Egla Rufa? Someone was murdered. They'll start talking about it. They'll find out who the murderer is. You know, someone must have seen something. So this was one of the ideas behind it. I mean, there are deeper ideas. But one of the ideas is to arouse our awareness when a person gets killed. Now, part of the procession is that when we do an Egla Rufa, the elders wash their hands. The elders of the city wash their hands after we slaughter the animal. And they say, we didn't spill this blood. So the Mishnah asks in Sota, did we entertain the thought that the elders were the murderer? They have to declare, we didn't spill his blood. So Chazal say, what they're saying is, he didn't leave our city without proper accompaniment. When you take care of a guest, part of taking care of him is walking him out a little bit so that he feels like you're connected to him. And then if someone thinks he's messing with him, he knows I'm not just messing with him. He has other people who are his friends and they're going to take care of him. If I'm starting up with him, I'm starting up with them as well. Part of the mitzvah of Achnasas Orchem is levaya, accompaniment. So when Yaakov accompanies Yosef from the hill of Hebron down to the valley, he is teaching him this concept of levaya, of accompaniment. This concept which is part of the mitzvah of Egla Rufa, of this calf which is slaughtered. La'arof means to cut from the neck down. not from the throat, but from the neck. So that's called La'aroth. So Yaakov teaches him this halacha, and Yosef will remember it. 22 years later, when Yosef sends wagons to pick up Yaakov, he tells him, and if you think I'm not your son, I'll prove it to you. The last thing you taught me was about accompaniment. So I'm sending you agalot, like egla arufa, to accompany you, to bring you back to me. So the last thing he teaches him is this concept. Yosef is going, and his brothers aren't there. Goes back and forth, and they're not there. Man sees him and says, I see you're not traveling anywhere. You're going back and forth. You're obviously looking for something. What are you looking for? So he says, I'm looking for my brothers. Tell me, please, where are they? So he says, they traveled from here. I heard them saying they're going to Dothan. So Yosef goes. Now, if you analyze this conversation, it makes no sense. He meets a man, doesn't tell us who the man is. He doesn't tell him who he is. He doesn't tell him who his brothers are. What does he say? I'm looking for my brothers. Tell me, please, where are they? Yeah, that's how it works. You're walking down the field. A man comes up to you and says, I see you looking for something. You say, I'm looking for my brothers. Tell me, please, where are they? Yeah, if you're a 5-year-old, I guess that's a good conversation. But if you're a 17-year-old who's very intelligent, that doesn't make any sense. Chazal tells us this was no man. This was the Malach Gavriel, who is called Ish throughout Tanakh. Hashem sends an angel to ensure that Yosef will find his brothers, so that the brothers will entertain the thought of killing him and sell him down to Egypt.
So it's all planned out.
You have to ask yourself, why? We regret that it happened. Hashem sought it that it would happen. Why? So Yosef follows his brothers, and he finds them in Dothan, which is also an unusual way of saying it. You find something unexpectedly. When you find something, the word mitzi'ah in Hebrew means you stumble across something. If he was told they're in Dothan, so why was it stumbling across? So when you guys learn Rashi, apply these questions and suddenly Rashi will have different meaning. I assume you've learned Rashi, just review it and you'll see that Rashi really answered all of these questions. They see him from afar and they start talking. And whenever you look at someone as being very far from you, you could say a lot of things about them. So they say about him, Vaitnakelu oto. They speak about him as a nochel. They say, you know, he is a swindler, and he is a liar, and he is obviously coming here to continue harming us. Now let's take an accounting of how much harm he has caused us. He has come to our father and claimed we don't maintain the Noahide laws. He has come to our father and removed Reuven from his lot of the inheritance. He is slowly but surely working to bury us, either between us and our father, or maybe he's even planning on killing us. He's just figuring out ways to bury us one by one. Every time he comes up with a different reason to destroy us. Yosef was always commenting and telling them what they were doing wrong and coming to his father and saying, you know, they did this wrong and that wrong. And Yaakov would come and tell them, you know, I understand you've done this and that, and he'd rebuke them. So they come to the conclusion that he is obviously coming again with the intent to continue destroying them, and they, as they're discussing it, they get more and more convinced this has been systematic with Yosef. It's one step after another, but he's on his way to bury each of us. And so they say, you know, common sense says if someone's trying to bury you, you bury them first. We have certain mitzvot that say, they have psukim about them. If someone's going to kill you, you kill him first. That's just common sense. You don't have to die. Why should I die? Let him die. Common sense, I guess, everywhere but here. Yeah. Yeah.
Rav once told us about an example of children that when one of the children goes to inform another one, Rav tells him, don't do it.
Right.
When Yaakov did the same thing.
He should have. It was a mistake. Where do you think I learned it from? This is one of the places I learned it from, right? So now they say, let's come to a conclusion. We'll kill him. We'll throw him into a pit here. And we'll say he must have been eaten by a wild animal. Now let's see what happens with his dreams. Now, there's one person standing there who sees a mistake. We'll discuss that in a second. Yes?
You said in the beginning that there are such great entities that you can't even see where they were. How come we suddenly talk about killing? We knew that it's not something that they can do, even if they think that we will destroy them systematically. Is it killing meant a real killing, or is there another killing meant?
Chazal understood they were ready to kill him literally. Chazal say that Reuben and Shimon, one of them drew his bow and arrow and said, why are we talking? Let's just finish the story now. The other ones, then they sent wild dogs, and the dogs didn't touch him. Chazal understood it meant literally to kill him. I'll try to address it in short, and if you think about it, maybe over time it'll sound better to you. Let's begin differently. What is the weight of being a Shevet of Am Yisrael, being one of the 12 tribes? What does that mean? Each tribe is an eternal force within the world, within Am Yisrael. 12 roots that go up to heaven, our sages say, corresponding to the 12 tribes, 12 Nuschot in Tefillah. If the brothers see Yosef as trying to destroy 1, 2, 3, 10, 11 of the Shvatim, to destroy them in their father's eyes, to destroy them ben adam lechavero, to destroy them, to bring them down, and according to some of the commentaries, they thought it was only a matter of time till he'd figure out how to literally bump them off one by one. They said, this guy is not a representative of the ideals we stand for. No one else among the Shvatim, we don't snitch on one another. How come is it there are 11, 10 of us and one of him? All 10 of us feel like we're okay. One of him says we're not okay. So Abba is taken by him. But we, how come all of us know that we're okay? None of us says we're wrong. And according to some of the commentaries, that's why the Pasuk stresses that after they threw him into the pit, they sat down to eat. They never had remorse over this decision. Even later they say, you know, maybe we should have taken into account when he was wailing and saying, he begged them. And they said, you know, maybe we should have had mercy. Not that we were wrong. We're going to see in next week's parasha, they're going to say, Alachinu asherinu tzarat nafsho b'itchanhno elenu v'lo shamanu. We didn't listen when he begged. But they didn't say we were wrong in selling him. And even here, they sit down to eat. How come they're sitting down to eat? When we had a civil war, all the tribes went against Benjamin. They finished the war, and they said, no one's eating today. This is terrible. One of the tribes of Israel was almost annihilated today. We can't eat today. They fasted, they cried. Here, all the tribes sit down to eat. They felt we were abolishing bad from the world. Yaakov had a brother Esav. He's not part of the lot. Yitzchak had a brother Yishmael. He's not part of the lot. We have a brother Yosef. He's not part of the lot. And everyone agrees. All the brothers agree. And when they make a pact to bump him off, no one speaks up. How come the brothers he protected, the maid's children, how come they didn't talk up? Meaning the picture, when they looked at it at that moment, they looked at him from afar, they started taking an accounting. What's he been up to? What's he been doing to us? Has he been a positive impact, a negative impact? How negative? How is he destroying us in the eyes of our father? And how is he destroying us as people? They reached the conclusion, he's a swindler, he's a cheat. He's no different than Esav. Esav doesn't fit in the Jewish people, neither does Yosef. They made a mistake, but it's unclear how big the mistake was. Chazal attribute this to Yaakov playing favoritism. Chazal say, Yaakov played favoritism, so the brothers were blinded. But the brothers here, Hashem is with them. Reuven remembers not too long ago he made a mistake. Why did he make a mistake? Pachas kamayim, because he was quick as water. That's what Yaakov tells him at the end of Yaakov's days. Yaakov tells him, you were quick like a running stream. If you would have waited and thought about it, you wouldn't have erred. In life, you shouldn't be quick. Well, Reuven is in the process of doing tshuva over that. So Reuven sees the brothers and they're about to err. And the rule in life is, if you wait till tomorrow, you can usually fix your mistakes. Rav Mordechai Elio, he should have a refuah shleimah, he said that when he was a rabbi in the courts, so they'd have the most requests for divorces on Monday morning. After people were together over the weekend, that's when things exploded. And most cases that came in and asked for a divorce in the beginning of the week, they tell them come back at the end of the week. And most of them never came back. If you just wait, if you hold off, so things calm down. It's a rule in marriage, it's a rule in life. Reuven sees, if I could delay the brothers from deciding now, then they too will be with me. So when Reuven hears it, Reuven says, don't spill blood, throw him into the pit, why should we kill him? Notice that the pasuk doesn't say Reuven thought they were wrong. Reuven said he wanted to save him, to bring him back to the father. The pasuk doesn't say he wanted to save him because he thought they were wrong. That it doesn't say. Nowhere here do we see that anyone felt they were wrong among the brothers, and we're not sure if they were wrong. Yosef comes, they take off his clothing, they throw him into a pit. They don't see deep in the pit, but there are really scorpions and snakes in that pit. Yosef is in the pit, and he hears them hissing all around him, and he's scared like anything. And that's why they don't get such a good price for him. He's in that pit and he wails, do me a favor, don't do this, don't do this, come on, Shimon, Reuven, take me out of here, it's enough. Nothing. They go away from the pit and they sit down to eat. Reuven goes off the mountaintop, he's focused trying to do tshuva over what he did, and sometimes when you do tshuva you need to be alone. And you... Shuv over what happened between him and Bilhah. He moved his father's bed. However, we understand that story.
He moved his father's bed?
Last week's parsha, sorry. Yehuda tells the brothers, you know, we'll get nothing out of this. Let's sell him to the caravan. Now, the caravan that came was the following. There were Midianites who were merchants, and they had Yishmaelim, who were the caravan leaders. But the Ishmaelim, they would travel everywhere. The Midianites, they were the merchants. And the brothers wanted to ensure that they wouldn't be recognized and that the word would never get back that they sold Yosef. So what they do is, they tell the merchants, we'll sell it through your caravan workers. We talk Arabic, right? So they talk to the Arabs. They're not talking to the Midianites. And the big bosses, the Midianites, they're traveling behind in their wagons. And the Ishmaelim, the workers, the ones carrying the camels, they come ahead. And the brothers sell him to the Ishmaelim. And this was a way of ensuring that the word would never get back to Yaakov as to what happened. That's why they don't want to deal with the Midianites directly. The Midianites, they were steady merchants, and they didn't want the Midianites, who would be the legal owners of Yosef, to know who was really selling him. And the truth is that this intent of selling a brother to the hands of someone else is really what happened to us in the Second Temple. With the Hasmonean kings invited in Romans to come and help them attack their brethren. And that's the invitation to the Romans. We brought them in here. When we brought them in, that ultimately led to our destruction. 100 years later, they turned on us and destroyed the temple. Yeah?
I was just wondering, you said you were speaking Arabic. Do you think possibly you could be Aramaic?
I meant that as an example. I didn't mean it literally. I meant they gave an excuse why they were working with the Arabs and not with the real owners.
Arabs or Ishmaelim?
Ishmaelim.
Arabs?
Yes.
The way they call them Ishmaelim, it makes it sound like there's like so many of them.
There were.
they're really populating that fast? I mean,
yeah, they were populating very fast, yeah. Yeah, the Ishmaelim were, they took many wives and had many kids. You're talking about like 20 kids a year, yeah. It goes very fast that way.
Nothing changed.
Nothing changed, right. So Reuben comes back at night, the way he was planning, to draw Yosef out of the pit. He throws down a rope and starts calling, Yosef, Yosef. No answer. Tears his clothing. Comes back to the brothers and says, you know, the kid's gone. How am I ever going to look dead in the face? So the brothers tell him about the pact they made with God that no one's going to tell. And they take Yosef's garment, they throw it on the thorns, they slaughter a goat, they dip it in blood, and they send it with a very cruel message. Yehuda walks in, shows his father the garment, and says, we found this. Do you recognize it? Is it your son's garment or not? Not our brother. Not sorry, Dad. Nothing.
Why would they apologize if they didn't want to know?
There's a way you could tell a parent that his son might be dead. You don't just throw a garment before him and say, do you recognize this? Is this your son's? What are you, stranger? Is this your son's garment? And Yehuda's going to be paid back very shortly afterwards. So Yaakov tears his clothing. And Yaakov tears his clothing in mourning. And the brothers recognize they made a mistake. They try to comfort him. And he refuses to accept comfort. And the reason he refuses to accept comfort is because for the next 22 years he's going to blame himself. He's going to say, how did I send him out to Shechem territory alone? How could I have sent my boy to his death? I did this to Yosef. So for 22 years the brothers are going to witness their father wallowing in pain. And Yitzchak sees what's going on. Yitzchak knows the truth. Binyamin knows the truth. And they're silent because the brothers have made a pact with God that cursed is whoever tells. So Yitzchak mourns over his son, Yaakov, who's mourning over his son, Yosef. And so for the next 22 years, the people of Israel are going to be shrouded in misery. The brothers are going to see their father. The father is mourning over Yosef. The grandfather is mourning over Yaakov. And everyone here is mourning, except for one person.
Was
Yehuda. Yeah.
Was Yitzchak still alive?
Yitzchak was still alive.
Wait, his grandfather was still alive? What about Rivka?
Guys, yes.
Why didn't Yitzchak reprimand the 12 sons?
I don't know. So, when Yehuda caused his father to feel like he lost his children, God paid him back, and Yehuda is about to lose his two children. Only Yehuda's children are really going to die. Yehuda's children are not going to be lost like Yosef. And at the end of the story, when Yehuda gets the signs, so Tamar sends him the signs and says the same words that Yehuda said to his father. Hakerno, recognize please. Those same chilling words that he told his father when he brought the garment dripping with blood. God soter, he got those same words back in his face when he had to admit, I did it. Now this is a story that we don't like repeating. We don't like talking about Yehuda and Tamar and going into the story. But there's a time when we do. Chazal tell us that when a woman is caught as a sota, and it is unclear whether she cheated on her husband or didn't cheat on her husband, so they take her aside and the elders say, you know, there are things we don't like talking about, but we'll tell you anyways. There were great people in Jewish history who erred. Yehuda, you know, he went with a woman, he thought she was a woman of ill repute. And when push came to shove and it was a question of a life going on the line, Yehuda stood up and said, I did it. I was wrong. We don't usually talk that way. We don't usually tell people that, right? We present the story with all the midrashim. But pshat in the story, that's what happened there, right? Yehuda thought he went with a woman of ill repute. Turns out it was Tamar's daughter-in-law who tricked him. Shows us how modest he was, how modest she was. They neither one knew what Tamar knew was him. He didn't know it was her. But at the end of the day, when push came to shove, Yehuda admitted. And so we tell the woman, if you really cheated on your husband, admit. Look up to Yehuda and learn from him. Great people admit their mistakes. And that's one of the messages we have to learn from this story. Number one, we see Yehuda got paid back tenfold for what he did. He lost two children. Number two, we have to know that when we make a mistake, we admit. When Yehuda admits, he could say millions of reasons why he shouldn't admit. What a chil Hashem. You know, she cheated me, she tricked me into it. What's going to be if people find out? Yehuda could have said many things. And he would have killed David and Mashiach and the future of the Jewish people and his own future. When Yehuda sticks to the truth, Yehuda is building his own future and the future of the Jewish people. For Tamar at that moment was already pregnant with the twins. She was pregnant with the future of Yehuda. Yehuda's future lies in those twins. Not in Shelah. Yehuda could have thought, I have another boy, you know. That's my future. No. Chazal tell us his future was with them, Peretz and Zerach. The details of the story, I don't know if it's time. We don't have so much time to go into. You guys probably want to do other things tonight. So listen to the other classes. There are many midrashim about the story. We presented one understanding. There are more. Fire away.
Why would they use the story for a soda? Where she could just say, "Hey, he was facing the death penalty." She is right.
Right. All the more reason she should admit.
Death,
right, but that's more reason to admit. She's going to die if she doesn't admit.
Yeah, but if she admits it, won't she still die?
But
if she admits it, she won't die. No. Then she gets a divorce contract and she goes to live a new life. If she admits, she gets free. When we take the woman who's a sota, we tell her, if you've done something wrong, admit. Your husband will have to divorce you. He has no choice, but you'll continue. You'll build a new life.
But I'm saying is if a woman admits to committing a capital offense, she's not persecuted?
No. There are no witnesses. There was no warning. We tell her, go build a new life. Don't drink the salt. The salt waters are for a woman who insists, I'm innocent, I've done nothing wrong.
So because she cannot be a witness against herself, or even a witness in anything.
Right. It's not an issue of testimony. Once she admits she cheated on her husband, so we tell her, you won't be able to continue being his wife, but start a new life, build from scratch. Just a second, yes.
Already salted water.
So we'll discuss that if you want later tonight. What are the salt waters? Yes. Doesn't matter. Same halacha. Okay, so Tamar is willing to give up her life rather than shame Yehuda. When she sends word to Yehuda, she says, the man who impregnated me is the man who owns these. She doesn't say it was you. She leaves it up to him to decide whether he'll admit or not. Chazal derived from here that a person should prefer to lose his life rather than shame someone publicly. Tamar was willing to go down, but not to shame him. We have to think about that. What does that mean? Shaming a person publicly is like we've killed him. You guys know the story of David, right? Yeah, David would walk into the academy. They'd ask him, if a man lives with a married woman, what's the halacha? Real good question. So David would answer them, he gets a death penalty, but he has a portion in the world to come. And someone who shames his friend publicly might not get the death penalty, but he has no portion in the world to come. They were trying to shame him publicly. Sometimes people shame someone asking very good questions, right? We have to think about what we say. Yeah. Yehuda says, yes, you want some?
Oh, I was just going to say, what if you shame somebody publicly and you know that's what you're doing? Like, you have no portion of what
you're trying to do. Ask them for a mechila. You know, all these things. What?
What if it's like you don't even know the person anymore?
You got to try to do tshuva. Tshuva can fix things, for sure. Okay, so the one thing we have to know is that God wanted this to happen. Maybe it's important to mention, Chazal tell us that the Satan is working very hard to ensure Mashiach doesn't come to the world. He's working very hard to ensure David doesn't come to the world. So you'll find that the roots of David and the roots of Mashiach are always shrouded in mystery. David has to come from Lot's daughters who marry their father because they think the world is destroyed. A situation of incest, right? Lot and his daughters. So they do it with pious intent, but at the end of the day, it's incest. They think that the world's being destroyed. They're the only ones left on the planet, and they have to restart the planet, just like Adam and Eve started it, and the children married their sisters. But at the end of the day, it's incest. So Chazal tell us that, so to speak, God sometimes has to bring the good to the world in a secret way. And that's something to think about. People sometimes think they're going to judge someone based on all kinds of things. You know, his parents were this and his parents were that, and he was born out of wedlock, and. You know, there was a guy in our community whose wife cheated on him and then became pregnant and had a boy. So the boy's a mamzer. But he didn't do anything wrong. Not his fault. You know, his father did something wrong. His mother did something wrong. He didn't do anything wrong, but everyone wants to stay away from him. What do you want to stay away from him? What did he do wrong? You can't marry him. You got a problem. He's got a problem. Shlomo Amel says, "Dimata ashukim, the tear of those that have been afflicted, ven them menachem." No one can comfort them. He did nothing wrong, and the same is true in many instances. We have to know. Lot went with his daughters. They made a mistake. From that comes David HaMelech. Here we have the same story, Yehuda with his daughter-in-law. From that's going to come David HaMelech. Rus and Boaz, everyone questioned, how could he marry her? It's unclear, halachically. Boaz said, halach is I'm allowed to. From that's going to come David HaMelech. And then when Yishai lives with his wife, there are going to be questions how she became pregnant. And from that's going to come David HaMelech. God always shrouds the growth of greatness in mystery. So we don't look for those mysteries. But when they happen to come our way, we shouldn't judge the products of those mysteries. We can't judge someone based on what his parents did. He's his own person. Yes?
Just real quick, in this week's Parsha, with Yosef, did Yosef know the gift that he had?
Which gift?
I call it the gift of sight, you know, kind of like the dreams.
He knew, yeah.
Did he know from the beginning of the parsha, did he know that he was going to have these dreams?
Well, he had the dreams in the beginning of the parsha, and he knew he was gifted, yeah. Now, Yosef is taken down to Egypt. Egypt is a place where women sleep with women and men sleep with men, and every immoral behavior is acceptable. No one knows who their real father is. That's why when there was the plague of the firstborn, many people suddenly dropped dead because they were someone's firstborn. They didn't know it. The Potiphar sees a very good-looking guy. Chazal tells there was a long haggle going on, that first the Egyptians looked at the Ishmaelim and say, how do a bunch of Arabs come to own a Jew? You guys must have been pirates. You picked him up and his family is going to come down here and haul him back. You guys are liars. So they called in the Midianites, and the Midianites called in the Ishmaelim they bought him from. And they had to bring sales contracts back, dating back to the brothers, because everyone said, wait a second, how do you guys end up owning a white boy? That's what it says. They looked at him. He was the unusual white boy in town. Everyone looked down at him. They wouldn't even eat at the same table with him. He was the filthy white boy. He was the Hebrew, the Ivri. Yeah.
Rob, does it say that he was like not pronounced?
White is relative. I mean, the Mitzvahs were darker. Yeah, but white we see in Chazal is relative. In Chazal's time, white is called Germani, Germanic, and it's unclear whether Jews were really so white as we. Yeah, from the Mishnayos, it seems that they were darker. They said they spoke about the white guys and they asked, could they ever have a tzaras? You know, can they have a white blemish? They're so white. You see from the Mishnayos that their given was more Yemenite. Like, we turned white, I guess. The country affects us. So, what?
You can actually, I think you see Ashkenaz.
Darker, sure. The land affects you. The land, the climate, the food. Yeah, with time, we'll all be like Yemenites. Wait, your grandchildren. Wait, let me see. So Yosef is purchased for his looks, and Potiphar figures he's gonna have a nice boy to sleep with. God sends the Malach Gavriel to castrate him, and Potiphar, his wife, isn't so happy about that, right? Neither is Potiphar. So, Gavriel. So Potiphar is later going to be called Potipherah. Now, everything he does, he's successful. But the rule is, v'chol asher hu oseh, whatever he did, Hashem matzeach v'yado. God made successful. That's the rule in life. You want to succeed, God blesses what you do. You take the necessary steps, then there's room for blessing. But it begins with our taking the necessary steps. Sorry, we have to end in 5-10 minutes, so we can't take questions now. He likes Yosef a lot, and then he puts Yosef in charge. So again, Yosef becomes the big boss. He starts looking good. So, chaya ra'a achalatu. So the bad animal comes to take him. And who's that? That's Potiphar's wife. Potiphar's wife is a pious woman. She goes to the local place where you can find out the future. You know, they have places like that today too. You could call the radio and they'll look at the stars and they'll tell you all kinds of things. Might be Avodah Zarah, but you could do it. I mean, I don't know if you could do it. Might be an Issa D'Oraisa, might be Yarg Valyavar, but technically, practically, you could call in and they'll tell you, I look into the stars and this is what I see. So it might be biblically prohibited to do that, but Potiphar's wife, she looks in the stars, and she sees that she is destined for future with Yosef. So now she says, he's such a tzaddik, and we're supposed to have a future together. So we got to do something about it. So she looks up to Yosef and says, come lie with me. No, it's innocent. You're in your clothing. I'm in my clothing. That's how it all begins. When Chazal tell us, we have to be careful not to think improper thoughts. We have to be careful not to be alone with a woman. Not to touch a woman. Chazal know exactly what they're saying. It's biblically prohibited. A person often tricks himself. Says, you know, nothing's going to happen. We're just A or B or C. Doesn't work that way. The Torah prohibits lo sachmot. Do not covet. Do not even think about it. Biblical prohibition, one of the Ten Commandments, right? So no person could tell me he isn't thinking about it. Doesn't work that way. A person has to control his thoughts and control his actions and stop 10 steps before that. Her first request is, let's just lie down together. You'll be clothed. I'll be clothed. What's going to happen? We're both in our clothing. And he refuses. Chazal tell us this is where Yosef gets the title Yosef HaTzadik. Tzadik. Sometimes we think it requires a tzadik the way we use the term today, to stand up to a test. But the truth is that the word tzaddik doesn't mean the way you guys think. Tzaddik is not a chassid. Tzaddik is someone who you come to him and tell him, there's a fire in your house. So the tzaddik says, oh no, I need help. Could you help me? I'm sorry. You come to him and tell him you have a fire in your house. The tzaddik says, oh boy, you must need help. You say, yeah, could you help me get my stuff out of the house? It's Shabbos. The tzaddik says, sure. I take 10 shekel an hour. That's a tzaddik, says the Gemara. He says, I won't cheat you, and you don't cheat me. I'm going to go fair. Fair is fair. My time is worth money. I'll be happy to help you pay me for my time. Tzaddik is not about, like we think today, I'll give, I'll do good, I'll be kind. I'll be kind, but pay me for my time. That's fair. Hey, I'll be a nice guy, but you got to pay me for my time. That's a tzaddik. And Yosef is a tzaddik. We're not calling Yosef a chassid. A chassid says, I'll give you for free. That's a chassid. Mm-hmm. Not the long forelocks and the garment. And, you know, that's modern day misterminology. Chassid, in Talmudic terms, is someone who's willing to forgo what he deserves. A tzaddik goes with tzedek, with the truth. And we don't have to kid ourselves. If we could only stick to the line of the truth, we'd save ourselves many sittings. Not many people get the title of tzaddik. So Yosef says, no. And he explains to her the logic. He says, you know, he's done everything good to me. He's given me everything except for you. You're his wife, but he's given me everything else. How could I do that? That's unfair. And It's against God. So she tries every day. And that's the way tests go. You stand up to them today, they'll be back to haunt you tomorrow. Stand up to them tomorrow, they'll try again the next day. That's the way life is. You never finish. So even though Yosef has contended with all the other tests, he didn't leave his faith, he's still close to Hashem. Even though he suffered at the hands of his brothers, he's still maintaining his faith, he's doing everything. So there are new tests to contend with. Life is about tests. It doesn't end. And even if we can't, sorry. And even if you stand up to one, there'll be more tomorrow. And finally, there's a day when no one's around, and Yosef comes home. One opinion in Chazal is he came to do accounting. The other opinion is that day he said, okay, no one's around, today we're going to do it. So he comes home, whatever you can imagine. She comes home and she grabs his robe. And in those days all they wore was a robe. Come lie with me. Chazal say he was prepared to do it. But he looked in the window and saw his father. He looked in the window. He looked like his father at that point in his life. And he saw a reflection. He saw the picture of his father waving when he left. He saw God made him see a vision of his father. And his father said to him, Yosef, there's a future. The Jewish people are going to be on a breastplate. The Jewish people are going to represent all of the world. All 12 tribes are going to be there. You want to be left out? The key to avoiding sin is looking beyond the moment. The sin is when I get focused on the moment. This is what I want to do now. You want to know the key to all of Mishlei? The Rav Sadia Gaon writes, all of Mishlei can be summarized in one sentence. Do I invest in the here and now, or do I invest in the long term? All of the Torah is training us that long term is better than short term. Build a life that invests long term. Torah values are the worthwhile values throughout life. It means certain sacrifices in the short term. So Yosef leaves his garment by her and runs out. And when she sees he left the garment, she yells. And everyone comes in. And she tells her story. Chazal tells there was a baby in the room, 2 months old. So the baby opens its mouth and says, that's a lie. And they look at the baby. What are you doing to him? And the baby says, I'll tell you what happened. God made a miracle. They all get embarrassed. Potiphar says, wait a second, we got to look into this. They go to court. The judges in court are the priests of Egypt. The priests say, well, so she claims he was making advances towards her, and she was pushing him away. She was pushing him by his cloak away. He claims he was pulling away, and she was pulling him toward her. Well, let's bring our forensic experts, and let's look at that cloak, and let's analyze where the threads are slightly torn. If he was trying to advance towards her, and she was pushing him away by the cloak, well, then he'll have torn the cloak in the front, by the neck. By the throat, right? He's trying to advance, she's pushing him away by the cloak, so then it'll be stretched or torn in the front. If it's the way he says, that she was pulling him towards her, and he was pulling back, well then in the back, where his neck was pulling away, that's where it'll be torn. And they bring in the robe, and guess where it's torn? In the back. So they tell Potiphar, you know, Mr. Potiphar, we got bad news for you, but the cloak supports Yosef's story. So now Potiphar is stuck, what's he going to do? Yosef's told the truth. His wife has tried cheating on him. Yosef has been an exceptionally faithful guy to him. He's done nothing wrong. Quite the contrary. He's run away from sin. So Potiphar likes Yosef even more. But he's stuck. He's got to save his wife's honor. So he puts Yosef in the dungeon. Which dungeon? The king's dungeon, where they get royal treatment. He figures that's an easy compromise. He gets royal treatment, and my wife gets her honor saved, and I lose my best servant. That's why in the end of Bereshis, the Torah records that Yosef freed all the priests from taxes. Why did he do that? He said, I still remember them. They were fair to me. When I was being judged, they gave a fair trial and they gave a fair ruling. And that's why the book of Bereshis concludes with Yosef's reducing taxes for the priests. He paid them back for this story. All the Egyptian newspapers were filled with it, just like today, that all the newspapers are full of it. So they were full of it then too. What are they talking about? Look at this Hebrew, look at this. Egypt's humming and drumming with people, but there's one Jew, so they got to talk about him. So what do they say? They get their version of the story in. They say, the Jew was caught trying to cheat with his master's wife. His master did everything for him, and he was trying to cheat with his wife. So God looks down from heaven and says, that's not right. So right away, God makes a political upheaval. Suddenly, Clinton is caught with, no, suddenly Paro's two officers, no, you'll notice, you guys think I'm joking. But if you analyze what happens when you read a newspaper, you'll see very often it goes like this. It's like a ping pong. God tries to fill the headlines. It's as though God is doing things to cover, don't let them talk. Sometimes they look, you know, the pasuk says in Eicha, Shiftam mekimatam habita. Take a note. All the nations, when they sit, when they get up, what are they talking about? Ani manginatam. They're always talking about me. You'd think we'd be this big nation, you know. In Darfur, no one knows what's going on there, right? 500,000 people have been murdered. Every day there's plenty of murder going on. You look and the Arabs unabashedly say, this is Israel trying to avert attention from their atrocities. What atrocities? They're murdering thousands by the day. But we're averting attention. We haven't said anything, you know. The Muslims in Darfur are murdering all the Christians. So you have thousands of people being murdered daily, but we're trying to avert attention. No one cares. It doesn't hit the UN. When it hits the UN, it gets buried. For the last decade, it's been buried in the UN. Every year, you're having hundreds of thousands of people murdered over the last decade. No one cares. Why? Here in Israel, a Palestinian gets shot. Now there's what to talk about. We build a home. There's what to talk about. That makes a difference. Think about it.
Of course.
Rwanda didn't hit the headlines. You know, Somalia didn't hit the headlines. Darfur almost never makes the headlines. Most people don't even know what's going on there. But Israel, that makes a difference. So Yosef makes a difference. Everyone's talking about Yosef. One little Jew in Egypt. So God makes it that there's another political upheaval. The top two to the king are caught. This one, there's a rock that gets mixed into his dough, and this one has a fly in his wine. And they have dreams, and Yosef interprets the dreams, and Chazal tells the dream goes with its interpretation. And Yosef makes a plea to the officer that he should represent his case to the king. And on Paro's birthday, he rejudges things. He hangs the baker and brings back the butler, and the butler purposely forgets Yosef. So Yosef is going to spend two more years in prison running into next week's parsha. And there's a lot to discuss. We'll end with a famous mashal of the Dubna Magid. It's a worthwhile dvar Torah for you guys. Yeah.
Well, we know that Yosef is going to marry the daughter.
Right.
Who was the father?
What?
Who was the father?
Potiphar, before he was castrated. So the Dubna Magid says the following mashal. Says there was once a king who made a contest between his painters. He said, whoever could paint the nicest painting will get a tremendous reward. So the painters have a contest, and they each paint a painting. And finally comes the day, the king and his men come out to the market, and they start looking at the different paintings, judging them, rating them. And they come up to one painting, and as they're looking at it, there's a baker there standing and selling his wagon filled with bread. They're looking at the painting, and a bird comes flying down, tries to peck at the painting, at the bread on the painting. So the painter says, you see how good my painting is? Even the bird was fooled. He thought it was true bread. So the other painters are getting nervous. What can they say? So one painter pipes up and says, well, your baker in the picture obviously wasn't painted so good, because the bird wasn't scared of the baker in the picture. Ordinarily, she shouldn't have flown next to a baker to peck at the bread. So the Dubna Magid says, that's the explanation how Yosef knew the interpretation to the dream. The baker tells him, I have three baskets of bread on my head, and the bird is pecking from the top basket over my head. So Yosef said, well, that must be an indication that you're dead, that you're going to die in 3 days, because otherwise the bird should have been scared of you to come and peck off the bread on top of your head. Let's end with something positive. Chazal tell us that when we have dreams, so the dreams go by the interpretation. Most of our dreams stem from indigestion. If a person has a bad dream, in Chazal's time they said he should fast. In our time, we say, try to eat less before you go to sleep. You'll have less indigestion, you'll have better dreams. If a person is really nervous about a dream, so in the Siddurim is printed what it says in the Gemara, that we do a tavat chalom. we bring in friends, and they, three friends, sit down, and you tell them, I had a dream, and they say, it should be good, God should interpret it for good, it should be good, if it was meant to be bad, it should be good, and they say different things, stating that the dream should be for good. So we do atavat chalom, if a person wants, he could give some charity. We should not tell over our dreams. Chazal say, we can't know which are good dreams and bad dreams. Person dreams that he died, that doesn't mean it's a bad dream. Person dreams all kinds of dreams, it could still be a good dream. In Halacha, it's brought certain dreams specifically. If you had exactly that dream, so it might have an indication as to whether it's bad or not. But in general, we assume we don't know what's a good dream, we don't know what's a bad dream. If a person's nervous over a dream, he should ask, he should do a tavat chalom with three people and not tell it over. Chazal said, chalma de lo a dream that isn't told over is like a letter that's never been read. You never read the letter, so you never know. That doesn't have too much of an impact. By the same token, if you don't tell over a dream, it won't have an impact. What you could do is interpret it for good, and Bezrat Hashem, when you have children who have dreams that get them all scared, you should always have a good interpretation up your sleeve. Sit down and think and figure out a good interpretation for your children to calm them down and put them back to sleep. But for ourselves, we should also formulate a good interpretation, but we shouldn't tell over a dream. Yes, Reuven.
Is there any indication of why children have more bad dreams than adults? That seems that's the case. I mean, like, I remember when I was a kid, he used to have bad dreams.
I don't know. Chazal have two understandings. One understanding says that very, very good people have very, very bad dreams. That David HaMelech would wake up every night in a cold sweat. Every night he'd have a nightmare that would really get him, and he'd wake up completely scared. And sometimes it's a good thing for us adults to be scared, because it spurs us on to perfect ourselves, to be better people. But there's another understanding that says no. Yeah, the Gemara says there was a rabbi that whenever he'd have a good dream, he'd say, well, the verse says that God speaks to the prophet through dreams. It says, b'chalom adaber bo. And whenever he'd have a bad dream, he'd wake up and say, ah, chalomot shav yedaveru. Dreams are filled with lies. There are two verses. One says like this, one says like that. So we have to be positive in our lives. We have to be able to say, chalomot shav yedaveru. Dreams are filled with lies. And if we think it's a good dream, so we could say like him. Yeah?
What are the specific dreams that we should worry about?
Nothing. I wouldn't worry about any dreams. Okay. If you want,